Welcome to The Firm Report, the show where we pull back the curtain on what it really takes to build and grow a successful law practice. Each week, we'll be talking with attorneys, marketing pros, and operational specialists from law firms around the country. We'll dig into real stories, smart strategies, and the practical tips that can help you grow your firm and serve your clients better. Let's get into it.
Do you see what happened with the kid in the outfield who got the ball? And he looked back and he said, Sirota, McGuire just hit 61. What are you looking at? Go back to the dark room, process the film, look at the after the game, because of all, you know, we're telling the story. We move all the pictures of the home run and of the winning, losing game, losing game. And we look, and there I see this kid's 2 feet sticking up out of the top. He hit a seam. And he flipped in the air, and his two Converse black sneakers, and the outfielder looking up, and there's the picture. I moved that picture. It's a double page spread in ESPN, the magazine, in Sports. It ran everywhere, and the next week at the next football game at the same stadium, Dolphin Stadium, all the photographers coming up to me going, "Dude, you slayed it." And that same photographer walked up and goes, "Bro, you know, you got me, man. I had no idea what you were looking at." So I won his respect that day, and I beat everybody just by, you know, being aware that a feature can be a bigger resource, a bigger moment of content than the thing that 200 other photographers are going to get, just with the same lens, the same thing, looking at the same thing. And everything about Home Run 61 was about the kid who got the ball. And they did a whole story about how he met McGuire after the game. He had a black and blue mark on his face. McGuire gave him a jersey. It was great. But there was no pictures of him contacting the ball, follow through, rounding for it. None of it was used except my shot.
Yeah, I mean, as a news junkie myself, the amount of production that you see where they're like cite somebody's Twitter, like X profile, or the sourcing on, you know, if it comes from a social handle. There's a lot of citizen journalism that's capturing photos and images that journalists just don't even...
Everything out of Iran is citizen journalism. Everything.
Hi, thank you for joining us. We have our guest today, Mark Sirota, world-renowned photographer and videographer and just all elements of the art. Thank you for joining us today.
Happy to be here, Zach. Thanks for having me.
For sure, for sure. Mark, it's been an honor to know you for a number of years, and definitely... I mean, look, when it comes to photography, a lot of us think we're, you know, geniuses right now with these iPhones and everything we could do. But, you know, your work is truly an art, and the way that you've captured photos and history through our time. Yeah, can you take us a bit, you know, through it? I mean, look, how long have you been in the industry for?
Oh, wow. It's, you know, I just turned 60, and I've been doing this since I was 20. You know, I went to the Art Institute of Fort Lauderdale, got a degree there in applied photography and photojournalism. Then I decided I wanted to maybe get into business of my own. So I went to a community college and got an associate's degree in business. But it really began for me in the mid 80s when I joined the staff of the Miami Herald as one of their two summer interns. And I spent about 2 years interning and then working for the Miami Herald, where they had the best photo staff and writing staff, probably in the history of any newspaper in the country. They had Edna Buchanan, they had Edwin Pope, they had Jim Barry, Carl Hyacin, some of the most famous writers, Dave Barry, excuse me.
Yeah.
And they also had those kind of photographers on staff that were winning Pulitzers and changing the world of journalism with their cameras. For the entire time I was there. So I began in the early 80s and, have transitioned quite a bit throughout the last 40 years of my career, from film to digital, shot some mobile stuff. I do underwater, I do aerial, I've got my drone license. So, you know, I fancy myself as a photographer of all genres, not just sports or fashion or entertainment or news, but all genres.
That's quite awesome. I mean, to be part of the news media in Miami since the 80s. I mean, we all know there's a lot going on, you know, in the 80s in Miami, and then, you know, into the high growth era of the 90s and where we're at today in South Florida going into 2020s. I mean, we are the place to be in a lot of ways, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the first stories I worked on was the explosion of the crack cocaine stories, you know, that broke through the cocaine cowboys on the Miami River. I was, I was part of the coverage that in courtrooms when Noriega was brought in. There was just so much news. The Pope came to the United States for the first time in 50 years You know, when Ronald Reagan was president, visited Vizcaya. I was there to cover that. You want to figure national disasters, hurricanes, one after the other, Hurricane Andrew, Hurricane Katrina, some of the, you know, most devastating storms, the election of 2000. We always seem to be in the news. When I first joined, the Dolphins were the only sports team in town, and Dan Marino was a rookie. But then you got the Miami Heat, the Marlins, the Panthers. We've got a professional soccer team. And then you add on the state itself, you know, Tampa Bay, Jacksonville, Orlando with basketball and hockey and football. Yeah, man, it's exploded. Not and fashion. I mean, I've worked so many runway shows for Getty Images on South Beach. So Miami Beach has been the fashion capital of the United States in and on, you know, with New York, as well as the art world. Art Basel was created during that period of time. I've covered that event several times. So
nice.
Yeah, you figure music, fashion, news, sports, you know, South Florida's always seemed to be in the news.
So, yeah, so definitely, I mean, you've covered quite a few decades of photography. And you told me back in the day with film that if you saw it, you missed it, right? And yeah. Today we're in an era where you could check a digital photo right away. But can you speak a little bit more to how, you know, when you were, you know, just capturing images before images were just, I guess, like a freebie, a giveaway for a lot of people. People take, I think, for granted a lot of the history that we've captured in film and video. Can you take us through that a little bit, you know, about, yeah. You know, just... that, you yeah. know, and who even told you that? Is that something you came up with, that if you saw it, you missed it?
Yeah, you know, I said it to myself once. I don't know if another photographer at some point, you know, coined the phrase. I've never heard anybody else say it. I use it a lot. Mm. I used to use it a lot when I was still shooting film and stuff, but I haven't heard anybody say it since. And I used it a lot in lectures and other things. And I still believe it to be true to some extent, because nowadays you're firing so quickly that you don't know if you have it until you look on it digitally. But back in the day, when we were shooting film, you know, there was no digital display, obviously. And in addition to that, you'd get 36 frames on a roll. You know, I have a card in my camera right now that'll shoot 5,000 pictures. So you also had to be very meticulous about how hard you hit the motor drive. Because if you were following through on a touchdown catch in the Super Bowl and you hit frame 36, and then the guy jumped in the air and did a chest bump with the quarterback, and that winds up being the front of the newspaper as opposed to a catch over a shoulder from behind. So back then, you not only had to get it sharp, because there was no autofocus back then. Now everything's autofocus, even on, you know, the DSLRs, the Sonys, the Canons and Icons that I have. There's such a thing now called eye focusing, Zach, which is like, I just look at it and it's sharp. Before, right. You had to actually get it there, or thumb focus it or finger focus it. So the technology's come so far, but you not only have to get it sharp, frame it up right, make sure the exposure was right, because film was nowhere near as forgiving as digital, especially raw files, are today. And then you would just fire it, and you'd have to hand the roll of film to your runner on the field to go back to the darkroom and just pray. So we used to call it prayer photography, and I used to tell photographers before mirrorless cameras, so even digital error on cameras that had mirrors that went up and down, if you saw it, you missed it. So in other words, when the mirror goes up, the camera goes black for a split second. So if you saw the ball go into the hands, or during a fumble, if you saw it squirt up in front of the quarterback or the running back, you missed the shot. You missed the ball. And all you have is the before the fumble and after. So, you know, we used to call it prayer photography. And funny enough, I think I helped coin another phrase after digital came up, and we called it chimping. Because if you looked in the end zone after a touchdown, all the photographers would look at the back of their cameras and go like this. And we'd all look like a bunch of chimps, you know, trying to see if we got the photo.
On the sideline there.
Yeah. And, you know, and so for me, you know, the technology has gone so far ahead. You know, early in mobile photography.
It's so when you say that, though, it's funny, because when I watch sporting events or go to live sporting events, usually see them miss the best moment because they're sitting there looking to see if they caught whatever just happened. It's usually 100%. The emotional reaction.
And I would tell young photographers too, the play's not over until they get to the bench. And even then, because there's players that watch the last few seconds of the Super Bowl, and all it is a kneel down and the Gatorade dunk. And by the time you get to the Gatorade dunk, if you're wheeling around and not watching instead of watching, you know, a meaningless play. So yeah, people like prematurely, you know, pull back, and the celebrations are usually the much better photos. Remember, football players wear helmets. Their faces are covered by face guards. Baseball players wear hats, you know. So, you know, you really want the celebration. You really want to see the body action to determine jubilation and dejection. And those pictures usually get the play. If it's the home team and they win, the front page is jubilation. If it's the away team, the front page is dejection. So you have to also keep in mind that the celebration also could come with someone laying on the field who just missed the interception or the sack, and they're dejected. Those are the money shots.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would even say, you know, I've seen a lot of greats play in sports, but I saw Ohtani live playing the Marlins, and just the emotional, I would just say the emotional power of the superstars. Like, it's not just in the game where they don't just leave it on the field at the one play. Like, they are emotionally carried on for, you know, seconds or minutes, like after the action.
Yeah, I like to tell photographers, and I lecture, I have workshops all over the world. I do a lot of mentoring for young photographers in sports and in portrait photography. I like to tell them that, you know, make a picture without the balls. And they're like, what do you mean? And I'm like, not every picture in sports has to have a ball or a puck, or, you know, or a racket or, you know, in it. And what do you mean by that? Mark McGwire came to Florida trying to break Barry Bonds or the National League record for home runs. And he was sitting on 60 or 61, and he needed like 62, I think. And he gets to the plate, and there's photographers are in town for a four-game series. And there's 30 of us sitting in the first base photo well and 30 of us sitting in the third base photo well, all keyed on McGwire. Every swing of the bat could be the record. And I'm sitting behind a Sports Illustrated photographer who's an old friend, so I won't mention his name, but he's legendary in his own right. And Mark McGwire hits it out of the park, and everybody gets the swing and the follow-through. And now he's running around the bases, and then the next picture you're looking for is him crossing in front of the pitcher, because the pitcher's going to have his head down, and McGwire's going to be fist-pumping. So now you've got jubilation and dejection. But once he gets to second base, there's no photo until he does the fist pound at home. And out of the corner of my eye, when he runs in second base, and you might remember this, in the old stadium before the roof, there was tarp in the outfield for baseball. And out of the corner of my eye, as he rounds second base, I see this kid running across the tarp to get the ball. And so I pulled off McGwire and looked for the kid, and I just started shooting, and he disappeared. And all of a sudden, the kid was gone. Like, he was there 1 second when I looked, and I looked back, and he was gone. And it was still the film days, right? And so I went back, and I rounded home, and I got the home plate celebration. And I looked at the photographer sitting in front of me, who was this Sports Illustrated guy that I had grown up idolizing. And I said to him, hey, do you see what happened with the kid in the outfield who got the ball? And he looked back, and he said, Sirota, McGwire just hit 61. What are you looking at? Go back to the dark room, process the film, look at the after the game, because of all, you know, we're telling the story. We move all the pictures of the home run and of the winning, losing game, and we look, and there I see this kid's 2 feet sticking up out of the tar. He hit a seam, and he flipped in the air, and his two Converse black sneakers, and the outfielder looking up. And there's the picture. I moved that picture. It's a double page spread in ESPN, the magazine, in Sports. It ran everywhere. And the next week at the next football game at the same stadium, Dolphin Stadium, all the photographers coming up to me going, dude, you slayed it. And that same photographer walked up and goes, bro, you know, you got me, man. I had no idea what you were looking at. So I won his respect that day. And and I beat everybody just by, you know, being aware that a feature can be a bigger resource, a bigger moment of content than the thing that 200 other photographers are going to get, just with the same lens, the same thing, looking at the same thing. And everything about Home Run 61 was about the kid who got the ball. And they did a whole story about how he met McGwire after the game. He had a black and blue mark on his face. McGwire gave him a jersey. It was great. But there was no pictures of him contacting the ball, follow through, rounding for it. None of it was used except my shot.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, you know, definitely. I've asked you about some of your photos and different, you know, pictures you've taken. And it's very interesting because it seems you sometimes buck the trend as to, you know, we look at a world where AI is being programmed by what humans would do or like what we would first, like, instinct wise want to do. Whereas a lot of your greatest moments seem to have been captured almost going against the grain in a way.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because, and I will give credit where credit is due. One of my mentors, who was a couple of years ahead of me as an intern at the Miami Herald, and then he wound up being a full-time staffer for the Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel for 20 years. He's retired now. His name is Robert Duyos. He taught me more than any other photographer about my craft. And one of the first things he taught me is to go where nobody else is. And because if you're in the end zone and the touchdown comes in front of you and 20 guys and girls have the same lens, the same camera, the same moment, you're only going to win the play by being the first picture out, if you're even lucky at that. Or people like editors are sitting at home. They want to go home. They have a hole to fill. Maybe yours is vertical. Theirs is horizontal, and they wanted a horizontal picture. But if you go on the opposite end of where everybody is and you wait, instead of a touchdown, it's intercepted and taken down the field in your grill, and you're the only one sitting 100 yards away when the DB leaps in the air and scissor kicks and celebrates right in front of you, you will be the one who, instead of chimping your camera, because you know you got a shot, you look up up and you see 100 other photographers on the other end going, oh shit, Sirota just kicked our ass again. And so I used to do that, you know, routinely, just go where nobody else is. But at a certain point in my career, there were a lot of photographers who would look to see where I was and then make sure that if they had a team of two or three photographers, like the Associated Press sends at least two photographers to every football field. A lot of times there would always be someone in my corner or my quadrant, you know, because they knew that, you know, there was a good chance they'd get beat if they didn't shadow me in some way. And I always found that as a compliment. And I always got charged up, you know, and I used to use it. I used to tell photographers, you know, where's your counterpart today? And they'd say, oh, on that end of the field. And I said, well, then you got your work cut out for you today, don't you? And they'd be like, oh, you think you're all that? And I would try to get in people's heads just to say, you know, I'm one of those guys who doesn't miss, and you better stay close, because if you lose me, you know, you're gonna be left wanting. And I would play, and these are friends of mine, right? People we'd go drink with, we'd eat with, or whatever. But it was known that I was gonna take risks and I was gonna come up with something. And remember, a football game's 3 hours long, okay? Yeah. Yes, you want every touchdown, every moment, everything, but quality is better than quantity, and I've always preferred that. And that's one of the reasons why early in my career I worked for Reuters News as opposed to the Associated Press, because Reuters was more of a boutique. They cared more about second day sales than about a thumbnail black and white picture in page three of the sports section. They cared about covers, double trucks, spreads. And then later on in my career, I joined Getty Images, where I'm still a contributor to this day, because they bought an organization called All Sport, which to me was the top sports photographers in the world. Still is today. Getty's staff is by far the most creative, innovative group of photographers, top to bottom, that I've ever worked with.
That's awesome. So, you know, with that being said and being in the right place at the right time, so you finished second for Pulitzer Prize for just, you know, something, being a kid from Miami. We all remember Ileana Gonzalez and the moment Janet Reno actually, I don't know if that's the only time an attorney general actually did the dirty work themselves, but she carried him out of the house herself, basically. That was quite a story. But can you tell us a little bit about, you know, your experience at the moment?
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, we're talking about results and results driving things forward. It's really ironic that happened on the eve, literally, Zach, and you probably didn't know this, I don't know if I've ever told you, of digital photography. I got my first digital camera the day before the raid. I spent the first 2 months on that story in Little Havana with film cameras. And the actual Pulitzer, which was won by my dearly departed friend Alan Diaz, the actual Pulitzer was shot on film. It wasn't on a digital camera, because he was just a stringer sleeping in a van in the driveway next door to Ileana's house, Ileana's cousin's house. So we're across the street. Every media outlet from CNN to Fox to MSNBC, plus AP, Reuters, Getty, plus the LA Times, the Chicago Trib, the Washington Post, the New York Times, all had folding tables with blue tarps set up across the street. We had phone lines dropped in. There were no mobile phones back then. We were all on pagers. And we had phone lines dropped down through the tarps onto the desks so that we could dunk film, a lot of us, in dark bags and process our film covering that kid coming back and forth to school every single day in Little Havana. I mean, I ate more pastelitos and drank more cafe con leche than, I still won't have that to this day after 20 years. But what happened is the day of the raid, Alan Diaz got into the house because he was a Cuban born man. He spoke the language. He had befriended them, but he had also done favors for them. And to his credit, anytime he went in the house to do special photos on Christmas, on Easter, on New Year's, he would pool them so everybody would have them. So it wasn't a violation of ethics, although some people who got their ass kicked that morning, you know, cried about it. Well, Alan got in the house because, look, Alan took the Pulitzer away from all of us. Me, probably one of the most, you know, one of the most forwarded. We were finalists. You know, a lot of people have images. Not a lot of people, excuse me. Out of the 200 photographers there at 5 o'clock in the morning on Easter Sunday, maybe five of us got the photo, Zach. And the reason being is when tear gas is flying and people are screaming and there's ICE agents with guns and gas masks loading the street and coming over the fences around you, you either sit and watch or you say, bring me the boy. And my attitude was, it's a football game. The running back's coming out that front door and I'm going to get a picture. So I got a beautiful shot of him coming out with the ICE agents all around him, an American flag, a Cuban flag. You know, it ran side by side with Alan's photo inside the house in over 200 papers worldwide. We crushed it, but there were plenty of people who were laying on the ground under tables who were, you know, fearing for their lives. And for me, I've been out there for 2.5 months. My girlfriend broke up with me 3 times during the coverage. because I had to work the midnight shift. She wound up becoming my wife. She was going to leave that next morning, go back to college because she was sick of visiting me and I had to work all the time. And I had to call her, page her and tell her, turn on the TV, it's over. But he came out the front door and we were using flash. It was pre-dawn. And I had gotten a digital camera from Reuters, which back then was a DCS 520 Canon / Kodak camera. So Kodak and Canon had to partner to create it, and it was $12,000. This is 25 years ago, Zach. 12 for the body only. And when you fired it, it went like this, click. It had a second delay, and there was no motor drive, and it had what we called blue noise, if you remember that. Like, they called it, we had to use a noise ninja filter because it looked so grainy. But Reuters sent it to me and said, start using it tomorrow. And I was like, I didn't want to. You know, my feeling was weight in hand is a perceived measure of value. Where's the slide? Where's the negative? Where can I, I'm going to put it on a digital card, which, by the way, was bigger than my wallet. Now you think about compact flashes, right? Yeah. Especially the ones that go in drones. It was the size of a wallet, literally, you know, the size of this phone almost sliding into the bottom of the camera. And it took 32 digital frames. And they were like 12K per pixel. I'm shooting ones now that are 158 megabytes. So anyway, all that going on, all the action, all the chaos, weeks and months of coverage waiting for this one moment that turned out to be a Pulitzer moment. And I got three frames. I got him coming out the front door. I got them throwing him in the back of the van. And then I got the agents coming back and getting in their car. And in the aftermath, there were protesters on the streets behind barricades that lived on the street. There was chaos, tear gas, screaming, crying. But yes, we you know, as you know, for Reuters, I produced one of the very few photos that carried the news cycle for months and months. And I'll leave you with one thing about that story that was more interesting. 3 days after the raid, there were protesters out there protesting. The election was about to happen. Al Gore was running against George Bush, I guess it was, the first George Bush. And Al Gore was the vice president at the time of Clinton. There's a guy standing in a Bill Clinton mask, Halloween mask, with a suit on, holding a sign. And this is one of another picture that's infamous of mine. And it just says, "Hey Al, forget about Florida," on the sign. This is Easter Sunday before, you know, well before the election. Mm-hmm. The election, that dimpled, pimpled, hanging Chad election that Bush won over Al Gore, was decided by a few thousand votes in Dade County, Florida.
Yeah, that was the old punch cards, right?
Yeah, the old butterfly ballot, which, by the way, has another interesting story. So with that, I think my most famous picture wasn't the Ilion shot, even though it was in Pulitzer consideration. Yeah. I believe it was that Bill Clinton sign, that person standing there, that basically said the election's coming up and the Democrats, because Clinton was president and Janet Reno ordered it and she was attorney general, they lost the presidential election, which was consequential because Bush stayed in office for 8 years after that. I think it changed the election. But if I can continue on to one other photo that I think was even more iconic for me, and I get asked the question but mostly by young students in high school, what picture have you made your most money off of? Was it Michael Jordan or Dan Marino or the Pope or P. Diddy? Well, now I'm starting to make much more money off my P. Diddy photos, but that's a whole other reason.
That's a whole other story.
What have you made the most money off of a single frame? And I tell them it was a picture I took of a piece of paper. And they said, what? And I said, well, after the election of 2000, when we had no president for months, in the first weeks, there was nowhere to shoot a picture of why we didn't have a president. There was the Emergency Operations Center in West Palm Beach where they were counting ballots. And Teresa, I think her name was Teresa Edwards, was the supervisor of elections for the state of Florida. Okay. So all the media was told to go to the Emergency Ops Center in West Palm Beach, right off the turnpike, that big building. And we all packed in there around the front desk. And they were going to have a press conference and let us in. So we're all the media's there. There's dozens and dozens of TV cameras, dozens of reporters and writers, and everybody's clamoring because, you know, before an election or after, you could get protesters, you can get vote here pictures, you can get election day photos. There was nothing for weeks. So they brought us in there. And when we walked in, I walked up to this little old lady at the information desk. And I said, can you just tell me what is the whole drama? What is this press conference going to be about? How are they going to qualify that we have no president? Oh, it was the ballot, she said. What do you mean? The butterfly ballot. I go, I don't know. You mean, I don't understand. What do you mean? No one knew what a butterfly ballot was. She goes, I'll show you. And she hands me a blank ballot. And I look at it. And the first thing I do is put it on the ground and take a picture of it. And when I picked it up to hand it back to her, all the other media turned, one person turned, and they started filming. And everybody's like, let me see it. Let me hold it up. And Teresa Edwards was just walking out to call the media in, and she saw me with a ballot in my hand, and she said, that's government property. It's against the law. You're not allowed to have that. Hand that back to her right now. And I handed it to her, and I'm the only one who has that picture. It's been in every magazine, from Playboy to National Enquirer to Geographic. Every magazine has used that in some way, shape, or form. And every election cycle it gets used. And I can't tell you, I must have made, since 2000, I must have made 20 grand off that one photo. Just on resales, off a picture of a piece of paper that I just happened to say, well, this is this the only story? And just cover your ass, put it on the ground, copy shot it. And if you go and you type in ballot or butterfly ballot and Mark Sirota, I doubt you even have to put my name in there.
Yeah.
You will see the picture and you will see links to, I don't know how many usages it's had in 20 years.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. That's really cool. Yeah, I guess not to go off topic, but interesting story and topic to me these days is how many lawsuits are being filed against the press for actually covering stories and maybe giving their opinion on a piece when, you know, as a consumer, all of us as citizens, I think we're entitled to hear op-eds and not, you know, see the media in the crosshairs as a result of like publishing information that might be later proven to not 100% be true fact or, you know, just there's a lot of like editorial and journalism. It's an art, you know, and it's definitely they should have the ability to poke and prod and be able to find the truth in stories or at least, you know, like you did with the ballot, like be able to uncover like the story of what actually happened. And do you have any thoughts you want to share in regards to like where you kind of see things evolving over these next few decades?
100%. I'll give you a couple of examples where the photography and photojournalists have fallen so short and have caused a lot. My feeling is don't believe what you see. You don't believe what you read. You don't believe what you hear. You don't believe what you see. I'm serious. It's kind of ruined. It's one of the reasons why I do mostly commercial work these days, where I can set up what I want. It's set up, it's lit, it's posed, and it's because I don't have to try to follow the guidelines that I've always been true to. And there was a Stanley Cup game where a photographer shot a goal. Now, hockey is one of the hardest sports to shoot. Get a little black puck going into a white net. It's a sliver. It's just a black line, and it travels 100 miles an hour. And, you know, I may get myself in trouble with the photographer. I won't say his name either, but let's just say that he photoshopped a puck in the back of the net. And then later on, when the picture was looked at closely, there was another puck that was tucked in the bottom of the net. So he didn't have to put the puck in there, but he did it because he wanted the picture to get the play or for whatever his reasons were. And his nickname for decades has been Tupac. But it ruined the integrity a lot for sports photographers. And to this day, people have, now there's things you can do to a photo. You can level and curve and sharpen to a certain extent. But you can't sharpen a picture 200%. If it's soft, it's soft. Don't use it. But people do anyway. And with clone stamps and with all sorts of tools in Photoshop, photographers take advantage when they don't have to. And it creates false images. I get asked about AI photos all the time. And I think it's pretty. I think it's pretty scary that, you know, you don't have to get the ball in the shot anymore. You can create, if the sky's not blue enough, if there's, you know, if there's an arm and then you cut off a finger, you can fix all these things. But you shouldn't. And there should be more journalism, integrity. I saw during the Gulf War there was a fight. And by the way, the photographer who took that second puck picture is still working in the industry today. I believe he got suspended for a while from his job or whatever. But and I don't want to see anybody lose their job, especially someone with a livelihood. Yeah. But that shouldn't have been the case. An example should have been set, honestly. But in war photography, I saw in the Gulf War, there was an award-winning photographer from the LA Times who had a picture of a tank with civilians riding on out of Iraq. And there were warplanes overhead. And there was smoke coming out of the back of the warplanes, these jets. And they darkened the smoke to make it look like the jets were on fire. And they turned someone's head so that the person who was riding on the tank, they put a different head on it and made it so that it was looking. The picture was dramatic enough, didn't need to do it.
Yeah.
That photographer also didn't lose their job. They were, you know, this is what, you know, should happen. There's been photographers who are in war zones who have a stuffed Mickey Mouse doll. And they find a pile of rubble and put the doll down to make it look like a kid perished in the war. But war is bad enough. Civilians die. People are taken hostage. It's horrific. And if you work as hard as photographers like James Noctway or Carol Guzzi, who are multiple war zone photographers, Pulitzer Prize winning photographers, and you follow their integrity and their lead, and I've been fortunate enough to have met both of them, worked very closely with Carol Guzzi when I was an intern at the Miami Herald when she was there before she joined the Washington Post. You learn how to do things the right way. Just like I learned from Robert Duyos, just go where other people aren't and you have a much better chance of winning the play.
just going where other people aren't. I mean, that speaks a lot into business and just, you know, and just life in general and just like making things happen. Even recently, there's a controversy right now about the Golden Globes. I think AI was slightly used in production of one of the movies, I believe, to alter some of the cinematography, even though they won the award. And that's coming up as controversy, or like where that actually like plays in, you know, not to go too off topic. Like, I believe that the Screen Actors Guild, the screenwriters, like they had a strike or a protest like at the beginning of AI's release. I believe that's going to be one of the first unionized, like, protests that we see as a result of AI and where it starts to take into just the future of like how we consume. And, you know, AI is definitely a game changer for every industry.
And it's got a million benefits. I get it. I've done my research on it for my industry. It still can't replace me from even an editing standpoint, from bulk captioning and photoshopping and knowing, you know, what to do and how to crop and everything. It still can. I could, 1,000 photographers can program it and feed information about what a good news, sports, or fashion picture looks like. And it still is going to require assistance from human beings. So I'm not really worried about it in that respect. I've asked some AI experts just recently about helping me with captioning, you know, helping me with bulk captioning when I submit hundreds of second day edits. And they say, no, you still, it'd probably be easier doing it on your own. But, you know, for the things that where awards are on the line, where people, you know, and you can't give an award to software, I think it's I think there's no integrity in that. And I think there's still room for the art form. Look, digital and mobile now has taken over my world as we know it. But there's still some film, and there's still room for people to be creative. And black and white is always going to be an art form. And so, you know, I just hope it doesn't. You know, people just don't use it to be lazy, like some people with autofocus, to be honest.
I mean, as a news junkie myself, the amount of production that you see where they're like cite somebody's Twitter, like X profile, or the sourcing on, you know, if it comes from a social handle, there's a lot of citizen journalism that's capturing photos and images that journalists just don't even.
Everything out of Iran is citizen journalism. Everything out of North Korea, when you see stuff, is citizen journalism. It's all done on mobile phones. But I'll give you something funny, Zach. Yesterday, I was driving back from Fort Lauderdale with Jessica, with my wife, and she said, "Oh, you gotta look at this Instagram video, and it's dogs parachuting, and look, they actually jumped out of a plane." And it took me all but a nanosecond to know it wasn't real. But it looked so real that even the wife of she's been married almost 25 years. She's been in dark rooms. She's seen it all, just like me. But even though she knows, and I've told her and I've shown her, is that real to you? Yeah, look closely. She got, for the split second, she looked, it was a cute video of dog. I'm like, but the first thing you got to do in that situation is think, what are the chances six dogs that are all yellow labs are going to line up together with their helmets on and jump out of a plane? And then go, okay, yeah, that's pretty cool if it's real. But, man, they can get anybody, you know?
No, I mean, they can. And, yeah, that's the I guess that's a part of the art form in a way. I mean, you know, there's the raw imagery and videos which capture the history and capture, yeah, what we all need to know as I guess, citizens, news consumers, and, you know, the information we're entitled to. But definitely, you know, sticking on the lines of, you know, being driven by results, you know, what form of work that you've done are you most proud of, where you've really driven results through your art form?
Well, I think nowadays, it's, believe it or not, it's a lot of the behind the scenes stuff. Like people, you know, I meet a lot of people, you know, all the time. Every time, you know, I pick up one of my cameras, especially long lenses, you know, you're, oh, wow, you must be a professional, whatever. And they ask me, what do you do? And I tell them, and, oh, have you ever been to the Olympics? Yeah, a few times, yeah. And then they, oh, you're so fortunate, you know, to get to do, you know, to do that for a living. And I always, I consistently, you know, appreciate what I do, but, you know, but I never really like take it for granted. I'm always, you know, really, thankful that I have the opportunity to see things and capture moments. And so for me, you know, being able to see results, is one thing. Covers of magazines, billboards. I've had dozens of them. I've got pictures right now of my own kids modeling for sports products that are in Sam's Club, Walmart, Dick's. There's a lot of things that make me proud. But I think the thing that makes me most proud is that people want to see what my job's like more than anything else. So the behind-the-scenes videos that get a million views or half a million or 100,000 views for some of my clients, because people want to see how you made that shot or what it's like to be on the set with LeBron James or with Michael Jordan or with, you know, or to photograph a president or a pope, or to be at the start finish line of the 100-meter dash when the fastest man in the world, you know, breaks the gold, the record, wins the gold medal for the third time in history. You know, I think that's, you know, the thing that I take the most, the results that I take the most pride in is how many times people view that, the comments that come, oh, that's such a cool job, because it reminds me of how lucky I am that I get paid to do what other people pay to do. And I get paid to sit and watch history. You know, I was at the Olympics in 2012 when Usain Bolt broke the, you know, won four gold medals and, you know, broke the world, you know, the record for the second time in the 100 meter dash. And I was sitting right on the corner of the start finish line because I like to shoot from lane one to lane eight, not in the middle, even if he's in the middle. So you can actually see if someone's going to pass him. Because if you're covering LeBron, Usain Bolt, and you're on him, you don't know if someone from lane one or lane eight is ahead of him. And if he's going to, now, you know, after seeing him a couple of times, he's going to win, but you got to be sure. So I'm in lane one on the corner, and the first row of the stands are right there. And the guy sitting right in the front row next to me looks over and goes, man, can I ask you something? Sure. You get paid to sit there, right? Yeah, I know you do. Can I ask you how much you get paid? And I said, sure. So I told him, and he's like, damn, he goes, man, I would do that shit for free. And I said, all right, I'm curious. How much did you pay for that seat? This is 2012.
Yeah.
He said, I paid $3,800 for 9.3 seconds. I said, you paid $3,800. I don't know what that's worth today. For 9.3. I said, is it worth it? And he said, what price would you put on history? And I realized how fortunate I am and how much it matters that people get to see the behind the scenes of stuff, how things are created, how things are done. First of all, so they could believe it's real. All right. Because what we were talking about just now with AI. Look, the cover of Vanity Fair and Glamour magazine and Vogue. We know those girls don't look like that. We know on GQ, guys don't have perfect faces and foreheads and hair. There's going to be photos of that. But that's not Newsweek, Time, People. That's not a news value. You know, go do AI and all that. We've been photoshopping, cleaning. And all. But it's also nice to show people the before and after. And if people did that, if people did a cover of George Clooney and then on the inside showed the picture when he first got to the hair and makeup studio, it would sell five times more magazines. That stuff would go viral. You know, I did a photo shoot with Giancarlo Stanton when he became the first $350 million player when he was with the Marlins. And I did the body paint photo shoot for Sports Illustrated. Giancarlo spent 16 hours in a studio in Miami. In wintertime, it was about 35 degrees outside, the coldest winter we've ever had, and it was cold inside, and they only body painted him from the waist up, you know, so with the uniform on, and we shot this picture. And the cover was great. It was the first time a man had ever been body painted. But the behind the scenes photos and the video that was made of everything, and I did a lot. I spent 15 hours and 30 minutes watching them set him up, and then that's I spent awesome. 30 minutes shooting the picture. The more interesting content was the making of it and seeing how patient he was and how many people were around him. There were eight makeup artists doing little drop shadows on the uniform and the logo. So for me, the behind the scenes stuff that goes viral is the most valuable stuff, the thing I'm most proudest of, and the stuff that only comes through technology, because you couldn't really have that. You couldn't have a film crew in 1999 come out and spend that kind of money on a photo shoot. But now you can just do it on your phone.
That's wild. Yeah, it's definitely, you know, it's awesome that when some of these icons of our time have been called out for photo shoots, you seem to be the photographer they call. I know you won't really admit to that, but I mean, Shaquille O'Neal, Tiger Woods, what, I mean, it just goes Dan Marino, John Elway, LeBron James. It's just like private photo shoots, or, you know, when a brand signs these guys up, who's the photographer they call? It's Mark Sirota. It's very awesome. It's got to be quite an honor.
I've been fortunate. I've never worked a day in my life, really, Zach. I get paid to do, like I said, what other people pay to do. And, you know, I once had Dan Marino said to me, you get paid to do this. That camera's autofocus, because I told him, you know, yeah, they autofocus now. And he's like, what do I need you for? He goes, Stevie Wonder could take pictures like you. And I had to laugh. But I'm also fortunate that in addition to having those opportunities and taking advantage of them, I think, you know, the way that I have in a professional way, I've met some pretty interesting people and I've learned, you know, just how fortunate, you know, a person can be to just live their dreams. And if you know, I always wanted to do this. I started sneaking my camera into rock concerts when Van Halen was on their first tour, when Aerosmith was on their first tour, Styx, Kansas, Boston, the Doobie Brothers. I would sneak my camera into General Admission shows, a 110 Instamatic, and I would find the biggest guy in the front row and say, put me on your shoulders. And I would get up there and take pictures with an Instamatic camera, with a Polaroid camera, whatever my cousin or my uncle had. And all I kept thinking about is I would love to do this for a living someday. And I've been very fortunate to live out my dreams.
That's awesome. Well, Mark, I thank you. Thank you for making the time today, and thank you for joining us on Driven by Results. It's been an honor to have you on and for you to make the time for me. So appreciate it. Thank you.
Happy to do it, Zach. It's an honor to work with you. I love any opportunity I get to spend time with you. It was nice that you came down for my big birthday party, and I got to see you and Marley. And I appreciate you, bud. Anytime, dude.
For sure. Thank you. Thanks, Mark.
That's it for today's episode of The Firm Report, brought to you by Exults, a full-service digital marketing agency helping law firms reach new heights. If you enjoyed the conversation, make sure to like, subscribe, and share the show with someone who'd find it valuable. You can find us on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.